Executive Power, Disc 2.
Even now, as he sat on the deck of his sailboat, anchored just off the coast of the French Riviera, one had to look closely to see what Alan was really doing. At first glance, he looked every bit the relaxed and retired gentleman, casually perusing the newspaper as another day in paradise got underway. But upon closer inspection, there were a few telltale signs that Alan had not entirely left the employ of his government. The first hint was a bit difficult to catch. It involved the unusual size of the radar dome that sat near the top of his mast and the odd-shaped antennae that sat next to it. The next sign that was a bit more obvious was that Alan wasn't really reading the paper. Out of sight, but within reach, was a small control panel with an array of dials. Plugged into this control panel was an earpiece. Alan at first listened intently to the conversation that was taking place between the prince and his visitor, manipulating the various controls in an effort to boost the effectiveness of the directional microphone concealed at the top of his mast. He had dropped anchor the morning before, just off the port beam of the prince's massive yacht, placing one other boat between his and the prince's. Under orders from London, he'd been loosely shadowing the prince for over a week. He'd even gotten to know a few of the crew members in the process. The captain of the ship was a retired French naval officer, as was much of his crew. Like most mariners, they were friendly to other sailors. While picking up provisions back in San Remo, Alan found out the ship was headed for Monte Carlo and then on to Cannes, a very common trip for the big yachts. Alan let it be known that he was headed in the same direction, so they'd probably be bumping into each other along the way. Things had progressed now to the point where the crew knew him on sight and waved as they went back and forth to shore in their power launch. Headquarters was famous for being skimpy with the information they gave to their people in the field. They'd told Alan only to follow, observe, record, and report. They didn't tell him why they wanted him to babysit Prince Omar, but then again, they didn't really need to. Alan knew enough about the dysfunctional House of Saud to know what his government was interested in. The conversation that was taking place on the big ship didn't appear to be what they were after, and the dashing young man who had arrived less than an hour ago didn't fit the profile of an Islamic fundamentalist. With this in mind, Alan checked his dials one more time to make sure everything was being recorded, and then he began to read his paper, only half listening to the conversation that was going on in his left ear. With the sun quickly warming the cool morning air, Alan let out a yawn and crossed his left leg over his right. The voice of a woman drew his attention away from the paper, and he looked across the water to see what was going on. From his vantage point, all he could see were the tops of several heads, and then a blonde beauty came into view near the back of one of the upper sun decks. Without warning, she dropped her robe and stretched her pale arms above her head, revealing a very nice pair of breasts. Alan lunged for his binoculars, but by the time he got them up, she was gone. He laughingly shook his head. He was slowing down in his old age. He was still smiling as he went back to his paper, and then, slowly, his face turned more serious. The conversation between the prince and his visitor had, without warning, gone from mundane to quite noteworthy. Alan checked again to make sure the equipment was recording, and then he went back to feigning interest in the paper. Whoever this David was, he would have to get some photos of him when he climbed back on board the launch to return to shore. As the two men continued their discussion, Alan decided that London would be very interested indeed in his next report. Chapter 7. Mitch Rapp drove across the Key Bridge on his way to a meeting at the White House. His mood was tense and his patience short. He was not happy about what he'd learned this morning. The honeymoon was over. He'd been back in town for less than 24 hours, and he was already looking to wring someone's neck. Ignoring his boss's orders, he'd left his bodyguard back at Langley and driven himself. He'd had some death threats lately, quite a few of them, in fact, but despite the danger, he needed some time alone to think before he met with the president. He'd promised himself that he wouldn't allow his new position of influence to be wasted. The whole reason he had this new position was that his cover as a covert counterterrorism operative had been blown during the boss's confirmation hearing by a congressman who had no admiration for the agency, and now every piece of crap from Boston to Baghdad knew who he was and what he looked like. His face had been broadcast across the airwaves. He was called America's first line of defense against terrorism. Virtually every newspaper in the country had reported his story, and there had been several magazine covers. The entire thing was unnerving to him. The media spectacle his career had become went against everything he knew. Most of his life, since the age of 22, had been a secret. Not even his brother had known that he worked for the CIA. Now, because of all the publicity before he even hit 40, he had been unceremoniously retired from the field, brought in from the cold, and given a new job and a new title to go with it. He was now Special Assistant to the Director of Central Intelligence on Counterterrorism. Terrorism had finally reached out and touched America, and her citizens were finally waking up to the fact that there were people out there who hated them, zealots who wanted to see the great Satan toppled. The president and RAP's boss, Director Irene Kennedy, had given him a mandate. In addition to working in conjunction with the agency's Counterterrorism Center, they asked him to thoroughly study the nation's counterterrorism capabilities and come up with a recommendation on how to streamline operations and improve defenses. RAP's first response had been to tell the president to start focusing on offense. So far, the president had shown no signs of following that advice. Kennedy, knowing RAP better than anyone, admonished him to keep his temper and tongue in check. She told him to look at the study as a fact-finding mission. The ass-kicking would come later when he gave his report to the president and the National Security Council. That was when he could vent and let the truth be told, and Irene Kennedy knew better than anyone that the truth did need to be told. If Rapp had learned anything during his lengthy study of America's counterterrorism efforts, it was that there were too many meetings. Too many meetings that accomplished nothing, and more often than not, created more red tape and hassles for the people who were on the front lines doing the important work. The meetings were a colossal waste of energy and resources. They never started on time, and they always ran over, and that was the least of their problems. Now that he was on the inside, after spending more than a decade abroad working covertly for the CIA, he could see why so many in Washington thought the agency had dropped the ball. The agency had become the antithesis of what Colonel Wild Bill Donovan, its founder, had designed it to be. It was a risk-averse haven for bureaucrats to put in their time so they could retire and collect their pensions. Sensitivity training and diversity workshops had taken priority over recruiting case officers with foreign language skills who had the chutzpah it took to run covert ops. Thanks to Aldrich Ames, the FBI had been invited to join the agency's counterintelligence center. The brothers in dark suits had eviscerated the ranks of Langley's few remaining good case officers for the simple reason that too many of the men and women in the Directorate of Operations were mavericks. Never mind that mavericks, independent thinkers, were exactly who Wild Bill Donovan and President Roosevelt had in mind when they started the Office of Strategic Services at the onset of World War II. Donovan and Roosevelt understood that you didn't hire decent, respectable, risk-averse family men to spy on the enemy. You hired risk-takers who were willing to put their lives on the line to get a piece of information that might make the difference. It was not a business for the meek, buttoned-up type. It was a business for daredevils who liked to gamble. Signal and photographic intelligence now replaced eyes and ears on the ground. The billion-dollar satellites and ground intercept and relay stations were clean. They couldn't embarrass you the way a turned case officer could. They didn't bleed. They couldn't be kidnapped. They didn't lie, and Congress loved them. The bright, glossy photographs of terrorist training camps and scratchy audio intercepts of our enemies plotting to strike gave them great satisfaction. The politicians marveled at America's technological superiority. There was one big problem, though. the enemy knew they were being watched and listened to, and went to great lengths to hide what they were doing from the big prying eyes and ears in the sky. Everyone in Washington knew this, but it didn't stop groups like the State Department from pushing for more signal intelligence. The alternative was putting real men and women in the field, and that could be very messy. Uncontrollable CIA case officers were a constant source of irritation for the State Department. They snooped around host countries, tended to drink too much, tried to recruit agents, and generally behaved in a way that no gentleman or lady from Foggy Bottom would endorse. Even worse, if they got caught, the host country would expel innocent State Department employees along with the offending CIA case officer, and the whole affair would upset the delicate dance of diplomacy. The CIA had become just another Washington bureaucracy, a money-sucking black hole of political correctness. In short, the CIA was a reflection of the times and its political leaders. Now, Rapp truly understood why Director Stansfield had done what he did. The recently deceased director of the agency had fought hard to insulate the CIA from the political whims of Capitol Hill. But it was a Herculean task that no one man could perform. Seeing the winds of change approaching, Stansfield had created a covert counterterrorism unit known as the Orion Team. The group's mission was to operate in the dark and take the battle to the terrorists. Mitch Rapp had been the tip of that spear for the better part of a decade. He'd killed more men for his country than he could count, and he had come close to losing his own life more times than he dared to remember. For the last several years, he'd seriously considered getting out. Instinctively, he knew that one of these times, no matter how good he was, the brakes wouldn't go his way and he'd end up dead. The decision to make the move was finalized when he'd met Anna Rielli. She was only the second woman he'd ever loved, and the first had been a long time ago. Soon after meeting her, he knew she was the one. It was time to get out of the killing business and get on with a normal life. That had all been before the towers and the Pentagon were hit. Now he wasn't so sure. An anger burned inside him. He knew the face of the enemy better than perhaps anyone in the country. It was the hideous face of Islamic fanaticism. It had taken all the restraint he could muster to not get on a plane and go over to Afghanistan. Kennedy had convinced him not to. He was too important. She needed him right at her side, using his language skills and contacts in the region to run down leads and try to figure out what had happened. Kennedy had vision, just like her mentor. She could see the goals of the competing agencies and interests in Washington and maneuver her way through the minefield. She knew that in the wake of 9/11, the politicians on the Hill would try to pin the whole thing on the CIA. Never mind that beginning with the Church hearings in the mid-70s, it was the politicians who had pulled the CIA out of the spying business. Then, in the 80s, it was the politicians, again, who told the CIA to break off any association with nefarious individuals, ignoring the fact that to catch the bad guys, you actually had to talk to them and their associates from time to time. But the politicians on the Hill didn't want to hear any of it. The CIA either had to bat 1,000 or get out of the hood. So, ultimately, the politicians got exactly what they wanted. They created an agency that was afraid to take risks. Chapter 8. Who could have known in 1922, when Great Britain created the new country of Transjordan, that one day its capital of Amman would grow into a city of international intrigue? Amman, a city of over 1 million souls, was a dusty old town that had been cleaned up and dragged into the 21st century by the forward-thinking King Hussein I and his son Abdullah II. Bordered to the east and south by Iraq and Saudi Arabia, to the north by Syria, and to the west by Israel, Jordan was a cursed piece of land that was poor in mineral and oil deposits and plentiful in refugees. Palestinians, to be precise, and lots of them. For the first 30 or so years after the formation of Israel, Jordan moved in lockstep with her Arab neighbors in calling for the annihilation of the Jewish state. But after getting decisively trounced in every military engagement with their Zionist neighbors, Jordan began to think of Israel as a dog that was better left undisturbed, at least as far as outright wars were concerned. If being cursed with a worthless piece of land wasn't enough, Jordan had to contend with a cast of neighbors that included the Middle East's most notorious despot, the ultra-wealthy and schizophrenic Saudi royal family, and the Syrians, who for various twisted religious reasons hated the Jordanians almost as much as they hated the Jews. With no real resources or industry to build an economy, Jordan, from its inception, was dependent on foreign aid. At first it was the Brits, then the Arab League, and then, with the promise of better relations with Israel, the United States began to infuse millions of dollars in humanitarian, economic, and military aid into the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. King Hussein became masterful at playing both sides of the fence, taking money from both his Arab brothers and America. With great care, he put his country on a course of neutrality and did not deviate even during the Gulf War. Despite immense pressure from the United States and Saudi Arabia, King Hussein chose not to jump into the fray. Publicly, he proclaimed that he would not take part in the butchering of the Iraqi people. Privately, he told his keepers that it would serve them better if a channel of communication was kept open with Baghdad. King Hussein convinced President Bush that the Jordanian General Intelligence Department would provide him with invaluable information about what was going on inside Iraq. The Bush administration agreed, and in return for cooperation with the General Intelligence Department, the foreign aid spigot of the United States was only reduced instead of completely shut off. At the time the agreement was reached, King Hussein had no idea just how fruitful it would eventually be for his kingdom. During the years of sanctions that followed the Gulf War, Jordan became the lifeline of Iraq. Goods flowed in from Jordan like a river to the sea, and in exchange, Jordanian coffers were filled with profits made from selling discounted Iraqi oil. Black market import-export companies sprang up in Jordan like weeds on an unkempt lawn. The French were the first to arrive, and they were quickly followed by many of their European neighbors, and then the Chinese and the rest of the Pacific Rim and Asia. Jordan got a cut of everything, and the entire racket became a massive boon to the Jordanian economy. All the while, with a wink and a nod, Jordan maintained her position of neutrality. Amman was the place where Saddam's henchmen came to replenish the ruler's military supplies and shop for his grocery list of weapons of mass destruction. It was also where the CIA and Britain's MI6 focused an increasing amount of their resources. Amman had become the Middle East's version of Cold War Berlin. Any country that was big enough to care had spies on the ground in Amman, and with so many intelligence agencies operating in the city, it was almost impossible to do business without someone noticing. That was why David had chosen to meet his Iraqi contact in the Jordanian capital. He wanted to settle a score, send a message, and muddy the waters in one fell swoop. David's connection to Prince Omar and the Saudi royal family needed to be protected at all costs. Yes, the Iraqis could provide money to the cause, but nothing compared to the Saudis. If the grand plan did not go as he hoped, David wanted to be able to point the Israelis and the Americans and anyone else who cared in the direction of Saddam Hussein. He did not want them to go looking in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for him. The green Range Rover snaked its way up Al Amir Mohammed Street toward one of Amman's famous seven hills. Night had fallen on the city, and they were headed for the Intercontinental Hotel. It was Amman's finest hotel, and the arrogant man David was going to meet would stay nowhere else. David sat in the back seat and went over the plan one more time. He had carefully applied a black beard flecked with gray to his face and had added a touch of gray to his eyebrows. Over his hair, he was wearing the black-and-white keffiyeh of a Palestinian. As they neared the hotel, he put on a pair of dark-rimmed glasses and checked his disguise with a small mirror. He looked a good 15 years older. He had met with the Iraqi on 6 previous occasions, and he had worn the same disguise each time. David trusted very few people, and none of them were Iraqis. He had caught them in many lies during his business dealings with them, but in truth, he had expected nothing less. They were the bullies of the neighborhood, and in the Middle East, there was no shortage of bullies. The Iraqis made up the rules and then changed them again when they didn't like the way things were going. David despised them for the way they feigned concern over the Palestinian plight. The truth was that there wasn't a single Iraqi who truly cared for the Palestinians. To Saddam and his henchmen, the Palestinians were nothing more than a lightning rod to attract anti-Semitism and hatred for America. As the Range Rover pulled up to the front of the hotel, David was focused on the task at hand. Tonight, the bloodbath would begin. If things went right, it would be the first step in a long odyssey that would change the face of Middle East politics. It takes war to make peace, and tonight would be the first shot in David's war. He stepped from the vehicle and buttoned the jacket of his double-breasted blue suit. His posture slouched and his stride shortened. He moved toward the door of the hotel, playing the role of an older man. The doors were opened by 2 bellmen who greeted David warmly. They knew him only as Mohammed Rashid, a Palestinian businessman who had strong ties to the PLO. David continued through the lobby, his Prada loafers clicking on the marble floor. He entered the bar and peered through the smoke-filled haze. The man he was looking for was seated in the far corner, his back to the wall like he was some cowboy in an American film. 2 of his bodyguards were seated at the adjacent table and were eyeing the rest of the patrons, their menacing stares reminding everyone to mind their own business. All 3 men had bushy black mustaches, a prerequisite for anyone in Saddam's inner circle. David approached the table with feigned enthusiasm. "General Hamza, it is so good to see you again." Hamza did not offer his hand. He simply looked at the chair opposite him and nodded for his guest to sit. The Iraqi general took a drag from his unfiltered cigarette and said, "You are late." "I am sorry," David lied, "but I had a hard time getting through the checkpoints." Looking down at the 2 attaché cases on the floor next to him, Hamza replied, "You'd better have a better plan for getting back with these. If you lose them, I will have your head." David nodded effusively. "General, I will not allow your money to fall into the hands of the Zionist pigs." The general reached for his drink with the same hand that held the cigarette. Never taking his eyes off the Palestinian, he said, "For your own good, you'd better make sure you do not allow that to happen." David again nodded and eagerly assured the general that no such thing could ever possibly occur. The 2 attaché cases contained $1 million apiece in U.S. $100 bills. It was money for Hamas and Hezbollah to continue their terrorist insurgency into Israel. General Hamza was not a man to be taken lightly, but David was far from intimidated. The head of Saddam's Amn al-Khas, or Special Security Service, was a brute, and brutes were easy to trick. Hamza's thuggish behavior was legendary. In Iraq, his name was spoken in whispers. He was responsible for entire families disappearing in the middle of the night, never to be seen or heard from again. On his orders, men and women were tortured and beaten for months simply because they knew someone who had been deemed a traitor to Saddam. Often, Hamza allowed those physically and mentally scarred subjects to live so that they could return to their communities and serve as living, walking, horrific, disfigured proof of what happened to people who went against Saddam. In any civilized society, Hamza's behavior and tactics would be deemed inhumane at the least. But what made his actions all the more reprehensible was that the overwhelming majority of the people he had tortured and killed had done nothing wrong. In the twisted world Saddam had created for himself, he was convinced there were spies everywhere, traitors lurking in every city and every part of his government. There was a purge at least once a year, and if the SSS didn't come up with bodies, Saddam would turn his paranoid rage on the SSS instead. To avoid having his own head put on the chopping block, Hamza made sure his people found traitors. Guilty or not, they found them. They tortured them until they would say anything to stop the pain. And then they executed them. It wasn't as if the Arab world was blameless when it came to such thuggery. It was just the brazen way Iraq went about it and the sheer volume of intimidation and torture that occurred. David could deal with brutality. He didn't like it, but he could handle it. There was something else about the general, something that really turned his stomach. And it was for that reason alone that he would enjoy killing him. A waiter approached and placed a napkin and a fresh drink on the table for Hamza. The man then asked David if he'd like something to drink. The general nodded his consent, and David ordered a scotch and soda. Hamza polished off the last few sips of his drink and then wiped several droplets of whiskey from his mustache.
"I've decided to cut your fee. We're spending a lot of money on you and not getting enough back. You need to step up the bombing against Israel."
The fee the general was referring to had already been cut once. It had started at 10% and dropped to 5%. It was David's cut for acting as an intermediary. David feigned concern. He had no personal use for counterfeit U.S. money, but he had to at least play the part.
"But I have already cut my fee once, and you will cut it again."
Hamza leaned back confidently and sucked on his cigarette until the end glowed a bright orange. After he'd exhaled the smoke in David's direction, he smiled and said,
"You are doing your people a service. The honorable thing to do would be to take no fee at all."
Honor had nothing to do with it. When David's fee was reduced, the money was not passed along to Hamas and Hezbollah. It was pocketed by the general. David was tempted to point out that they were in this together, Arab brothers arm in arm doing battle against the Israelis, but he decided to leave the general's hypocrisy unchallenged. He needed the money for the next part of his plan, and the fact that it was counterfeit was all the better. His drink arrived, and in a defensive tone he said, "But, General, the cost of doing business in my land is very expensive. Many people need to be paid to assure the safe transfer of your very much appreciated funds."
"You should be paying no one,"
snarled Hamza.
"You should slit the throat of the first person who gets in your way. Hamas and Hezbollah are on a mission from Allah, and anyone who trifles with them should be dealt with harshly."
The general shook his head in disgust.
"You will never defeat the Israelis until you learn to control your own people."
Biting down on his tongue to restrain himself from smiling, David nodded thoughtfully. He and the general had arrived at the same conclusion, but for different reasons. David would unite the Palestinian people, and he would start by killing the arrogant Iraqi brute who was sitting across from him. Chapter 9. Rapp was shown into the Oval Office by one of the president's aides. He found his boss, Irene Kennedy, and General Flood, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, sitting alone on one of the couches with a series of folders spread out on the coffee table. Rapp could tell instantly that Kennedy had broken the news to the four-star general. The stony expression on the soldier's face said it all. It was hard enough to lose men in battle, but it was beyond infuriating to know that it could have been prevented. Rapp decided that given the subject at hand, it was better for him not to speak. Before he had a chance to sit, President Hayes entered his office with a cortege of aides trailing him. At over 6 feet tall, with a full head of salt and pepper hair, Hayes stood out in a crowd, and like most men who had reached his station in life, he exuded a real magnetism. The men and women who worked for him wanted desperately to please him. Hayes unbuttoned his suit coat as he strode toward his desk. By the time he reached it, the coat was off. He turned to face the three aides who were arguing about the administration's education bill. Hayes held up his hands, palms out, and the three fell silent like well-disciplined kids obeying their father. As Rapp watched the exchange take place, he noticed, not for the first time, that the president had gained a little weight. It was a subject the two men had discussed on several occasions. Rapp, a former triathlete, still worked out 6 days a week and watched his intake closely. The president had confided in him that he was very wary of what his job was doing to his health. After all his official duties, which there was scarcely enough time for, there was still the Democratic Party and its incessant need to raise money. Barely a day passed when there wasn't a fundraiser of some sort, and where there was a fundraiser, one could always count on lots of food and booze. Rapp had designed a bare-bones workout plan that the president could do in 45 minutes. The goal was to do it 5 days a week, first thing in the morning. As Rapp looked at the president's expanding waistline, he had a feeling the man had been skipping his workouts. "I don't want to talk about this anymore," said the president firmly. "By the end of the day, I want you all on the same page. If the three of you can't come up with a consensus, this thing will be dead before it reaches the hill." One of the aides tried to get in a last word, but the president cut her off with a terse motion toward the door. The three left the room dejectedly and closed the door behind them. Hayes dropped into his chair and picked up a pair of reading glasses from the desk. After quickly glancing over his schedule, he pressed his intercom button and said, "Cheryl, I don't want to be interrupted for the next 15 minutes."
"Yes, Mr. President," came the always even reply of his gatekeeper.
Hayes looked up and waved for his three visitors to join him.
"Pull up a chair, if you don't mind. I have to look over a few things while we talk."
Kennedy had called the meeting, and she didn't object. She knew once the president heard what she had to say, she'd have his rapt attention. As they settled in, the president picked up a document from his desk, scanned it, and then moved it to another pile. Looking over the top of his reading glasses, he said,
"Mitchell, you look tan and rested. I trust you had a nice honeymoon?"
The president smiled.
"Very nice, thank you, sir."
"Good."
Getting down to business, Hayes turned to Kennedy and said,
"I get the impression that whatever it is, you have to tell me it's not good."
"That's correct, sir."
Before Kennedy had a chance to elaborate, the door to their left flew open, and the president's chief of staff entered the room with a big cup of Starbucks coffee in one hand and a cell phone and stack of files precariously balanced in the other.
"Sorry I'm late."
Rapp leaned forward and shot his boss a questioning look. He mouthed the words, "What the hell is she doing here?" Kennedy made a calming motion with her hand and ignored Rapp. Kennedy's cool attitude did nothing to still Rapp's apprehension over Valerie Jones. She was a pushy and obnoxious political operative. If she were a man, she would be referred to as a tough bastard or prick. But since she wore a skirt to work, she was simply called a bitch. Rapp couldn't remember a time when he hadn't been at odds with the woman. Her first reaction at the onset of any potential crisis was to ask how it would affect the president's poll numbers. It drove Rapp nuts that every issue had to be parsed, muddied, and then spun. Putting Rapp in a room with Jones was like one of those crazy chemistry experiments where you started pouring different things into a beaker, knowing full well there would be an explosion and, ultimately, a mess to clean up. With Jones now in attendance, it was highly likely that Rapp's mood would go from sour to downright shitty. Before the meeting was over, things would get ugly between the two, and Kennedy was counting on just that. For things to work out the way she hoped, everyone needed to play their role, and in the end, she was confident where the president would come down. Irene Kennedy had learned many things from her old boss, Thomas Stansfield. He had been fond of reminding her frequently that they were in the secret business, both collecting and keeping. Common sense dictated that the less one talked, the more likely it was one would learn secrets rather than give them away. He also liked to say the outcome of a meeting is often decided before a single word is spoken. It is decided by who is asked to attend. That was exactly what Kennedy had had in mind when she invited Jones. The woman could adopt a passive attitude if she absolutely had to. If a foreign head of state was visiting the White House, she might tone her act down, but that was about it. Valerie Jones was an obsessive, compulsive workaholic who lived and breathed politics. It was her life. She wanted to be involved in every decision, for in the arena of politics, anything the president attached his name to would ultimately affect his chances for re-election. Nudging a small bust of President Eisenhower out of her way, the president's chief of staff plopped her files down on the corner of his desk. Neither Rapp nor General Flood made an effort to get her a chair. In the PC world of DC politics, both knew such a gesture could be misperceived, and they might get their balls chewed off. And besides, neither of them liked Jones enough to make the effort. When the chief of staff was settled, the president looked at Kennedy and said, "Let's hear it." The ever-placid Kennedy cocked her head slightly and brushed a strand of her shoulder-length brown hair behind her ear. As had been the case all too often lately, she was the bearer of bad news. "Mr. President, General Flood informs me that you've been fully briefed on the failed hostage rescue in the Philippines." "Yes," answered the president in a sour tone, "and needless to say, I'm not happy about it." "I'd like to remind everyone," interrupted the president's chief of staff, "that I thought that entire operation was a bad idea from the start." Ignoring Jones, Kennedy held up one of the two red folders and said, "I think I can shed some light on what went wrong, sir." Hayes, his curiosity piqued, placed his forearms squarely on the desk and said, "I'm all ears." "In this file," Kennedy held up her left hand, "I have a list of email and telephone transcripts. You will remember that before launching the rescue operation, we decided that for reasons of operational security, our embassy in the Philippines would not be notified until the teams and the hostages were safely extracted."
"General, I don't like this any more than you do," the president's chief of staff said a little defensively. "But the State Department will not take kindly to being spied on by the CIA, the NSA, or whoever."
"Tough shit,"
answered Rapp before Flood or Kennedy could say a word. All eyes turned to Rapp, who was sitting on the opposite side of the desk. Jones, not one to be intimidated easily, said,
"I beg your pardon?"
Rapp's dark, penetrating eyes were locked on to the president's chief of staff. "Two sailors are dead, and at least two more have had their careers ended due to the injuries they've suffered. Lives have been destroyed, Valerie. Children will never see their fathers again. Two women have been widowed, and we still have an entire family of Americans held hostage in the Philippines, all because a couple of diplomats couldn't keep their mouths shut." Jones snatched one of the pieces of paper from the president's desk and defiantly shook it.
"This is not conclusive."
Rather than waste his time screaming at Jones, Rapp looked to Kennedy, anticipating the evidence that would silence the president's right-hand woman. Calmly, Kennedy said,
"Sir, there's more.
After receiving the heads-up from Assistant Secretary Petrie, Ambassador Cox phoned Philippine President Quirino." Kennedy handed the president a copy of the conversation. "An hour after that conversation took place, Ambassador Cox arrived at the presidential palace, where he stayed for approximately 30 minutes. We don't know what was said between the ambassador and President Quirino, but shortly after the ambassador left, President Quirino placed a phone call to General Moro of the Philippine Army. As I'm sure you're aware, General Moro has been in charge of trying to track down Abu Sayyaf for the last year. He has repeatedly promised that he will free the Anderson family and deal harshly with the terrorists. On two separate occasions, the general has had Abu Sayyaf cornered, only to have them miraculously escape. Our military advisors in the region began to smell a rat, and the DOD asked us to put the general under surveillance. This was over 5 months ago." Kennedy opened the second folder
and handed the president a fresh set of documents. It turns out General Morrow is not such a good ally after all. We didn't know it at the time, but he was a very active advocate of kicking the U.S. Navy out of Subic Bay. He wields great influence in a country where bribes are a way of life. We found several bank accounts, one in Hong Kong and the other in Jakarta. It looks like the general has been in the pocket of the Chinese for the better part of the last decade. And more recently, we think he began extorting protection money from Abu Sayyaf. Jones scoffed at the idea.
You mean to tell me that a bunch of peasants running around in the jungles over there can scrape up enough money to bribe a general in the Philippine army?
That's exactly what I'm saying, replied an even-keeled Kennedy.
That's one of the most ludicrous things I've ever heard.
Kennedy resisted the urge to tell Jones that if she'd paid attention to her intelligence briefings, she'd know that the idea was far from ludicrous. People in Washington had long memories, and another thing Thomas Stansfield had taught her was to avoid making it personal. Abu Sayyaf is not just some poor group of peasants. They receive millions in funding from various Muslim groups throughout the Middle East. Much of it comes from Saudi Arabia. The president did not want to get into that mess right now, so he focused his gray eyes on General Flood and asked, "Was General Morrow informed by us of any aspect of the rescue mission prior to it being launched?"
"No," answered Flood. "For reasons that are all too apparent, the plan was to keep the Philippine army in the dark until we were on our way out with the Andersons."
Flood shrugged.
"We didn't trust them enough to bring them in on it, and if we didn't ask for permission, they couldn't say no."
The chief of staff rolled her eyes and said,
"I'd hate to think what the U.S. Army would do if a foreign country conducted a military operation on American soil without our permission."
Rapp leaned forward, almost coming out of his chair entirely, and looked angrily at Jones.
"They wouldn't have to, because we'd never allow a group of terrorists to kidnap foreign citizens in the United States. We'd go kick the door down and solve the problem before you even had enough time to collect polling data."
Jones stood and crossed her arms defiantly.
"Mr. Rapp, we're all aware that you are predisposed to using violence to solve a problem. But I would like to ask you where that has gotten us."
Not giving him a chance to reply, she continued,
"Our list of allies is shrinking. These little operations that you are so fond of have alienated some of our strongest supporters. The Filipinos are going to make some serious hay out of this. Our own State Department is going to be livid with us for spying on them and not letting them do their jobs. And before this is over," she angrily pointed at Rapp, "you mark my words, there will be a congressional investigation into whose bonehead idea this whole thing was."
The blood rushed to Rapp's face, though he was too tanned for it to be apparent to the others in the room. He stood to face Jones eye to eye. It took all his self-control to speak somewhat evenly. "Valerie, you have great political instincts, but you are an absolute moron when it comes to issues of national security. Your ideas are dangerous, your logic is flawed, and nothing I've heard you say here today is based on sound moral judgment."
"Moral judgment?" she asked snidely. "You're going to lecture me on morality?"
The implication was clear. Rapp was a killer, and thus should forfeit his right to judge. He ignored her condescension and said, "Here are the facts, Valerie. A family of American citizens was on vacation and were kidnapped by a well-known terrorist group that is a self-admitted sworn enemy of the United States. We now know that the Philippine general in charge of freeing those hostages is taking bribes from the terrorists who hold them. We know that a decision was made to use U.S. special forces to free the hostages. That decision was completely legal and made by none other than the commander-in-chief." Rapp pointed at the president. "Part of those operational orders were that neither our embassy in the Philippines nor the Philippine government were to be informed of the rescue operation. Two senior State Department officials willingly disregarded those orders, and as a direct result, a platoon of SEALs was ambushed on a beach two nights ago." With her arms folded defiantly across her chest, Jones asked,
"Are you done?"
Rapp strained to keep from reaching out and slapping her. With a clenched jaw, he replied, "No. This morning, while you were yapping on your cell phone and picking up your triple mocha frappuccino or whatever the hell it is that you drink, a cargo plane landed out in San Diego. Do you know what it was carrying?" Jones glared at Rapp with unvarnished hatred. No one, not even the president, had ever spoken to her this way.
Now,
two flag-draped caskets, Valerie. Rapp held up his fingers. There were little kids, wives, and some grandparents there to meet those caskets. Their lives are turned upside down. The men they loved, the men they adored, the men they idolized are gone forever. They are feeling pain right now that you can't even begin to understand, and all because a couple of self-important bureaucrats over at the State Department couldn't keep their damn mouths shut. Rapp's eyes were filled with rage. If I had it my way, Valerie, I'd march Ambassador Cox and Assistant Secretary Petrie out in front of a firing squad and have them shot. Jones flapped her arms and roared, "I can't believe I'm hearing this." She looked around for someone to second her opinion, but no one backed her up. Dumbfounded, she looked back at Rapp and said, "I think you've lost it."
"I lost it a long time ago, Valerie, and I could give a rat's ass what you think of me. I've been on that beach thousands of miles away. I've crawled out of the surf, wondering if I'm going to catch a bullet right between the eyes."
Rapp marked the spot with his index finger. "I've seen a helicopter filled with young men blown from the sky because an arrogant senator couldn't keep his mouth shut."
Jones's arms were again folded across her chest, and in a disinterested tone she said,
"I'm well aware of what you've done for a living."
Rapp stood with his feet firmly planted, seething with anger. "I can take a lot of crap from people, Valerie, but one thing I can't stand is a lack of gratitude. I'm one of those guys on the beach getting shot at, trying to do the right thing, risking it all for love of country, duty, and honor, words that mean nothing to you. I've been there, and you haven't." He pointed at her. "No Starbucks coffee, no dinners at Morton's, no warm baths, just a lot of bugs, salty MREs, and the comforting thought that there are a lot of self-centered Americans who will never be able to appreciate the sacrifice you've made."
"So, yeah, I guess I've lost it a bit," Rapp said in a calmer voice. "And that's why I'm not going to let you protect those arrogant assholes over at the State Department. The CIA had Ames, the FBI had Hansen, and now the State Department is going to have Cox and Petrie. Things are going to get real uncomfortable for the ambassador and the undersecretary, and that piece of shit General Morrow is going to get his, I can promise you that."
Jones still stood defiantly and asked for a second time, "Are you done?" Rapp's face actually broke into a smile. He looked at the president for a moment. Hayes was notorious for letting his aides battle it out. His motto was that he'd rather get it all out in the open than let it fester under the surface. Looking at Jones, Rapp thought, "I can't believe I actually saved this woman's life." Shaking his head, he said, "I've got one last thing to say. If it wasn't for me, Valerie, you'd be dead." Rapp turned and started for the door. Over his shoulder, he said, "So I'd appreciate a little more gratitude." When Rapp reached the door, he opened it and looked back at Jones. "Oh, and by the way, you'd better figure out how you're going to spin this when it breaks, because I'm not going to stay quiet."
Chapter 10.
The room was located on the 7th floor of the hotel. David slid his passkey into the slot, and when the light turned green, he placed his forearm on the handle and opened the door. His meeting with General Hamza hadn't lasted long, and knowing what the future had in store for the Iraqi thug helped to make their encounter more bearable than usual. Fortunately, Hamza hadn't indulged in his usual hour of browbeating and self-aggrandizement. The general was very fond of reminding his contact of the Palestinian people's position in the Arab pecking order. In Hamza's exalted point of view, the Palestinians ranked just above camel dung. When the general finished his drink and stood to leave, David knew what was causing him to cut short tonight's lecture. There was something in Hamza's room that the general wanted to get back to. It was for that reason that David was in a hurry. His spies had followed the general's men earlier in the day and had witnessed them once again kidnap a young girl. He'd never left the hotel. After watching the general and his bodyguards leave, David waited a few minutes and then headed for the lobby. One of his people met him and took the cases. David then headed up to the room that he'd checked into 3 days earlier. Grabbing a pair of latex gloves from his pocket, he went to work. In front of the bathroom mirror, he peeled off the beard and wiped clean the gray dye from his hair and eyebrows. Both the beard and the damp washcloth were placed in a Ziploc bag. Next, he took off the suit and shoes and grabbed a backpack from the closet. He put on a pair of black pants, black tennis shoes, dark shirt and coat, and then rolled the other clothes up tightly and stuffed everything into the backpack. After going over the room one last time to make sure he wasn't leaving anything behind, David walked to the sliding glass door and yanked it open. Before stepping onto the balcony, he peered to his left and right to see if anyone was about. With the balconies on either side clear, David casually walked outside and continued his surveillance. From one of the rooms below, he could hear loud music playing on a stereo. David's eyes burned with hatred at the thought of what might already be happening. General Hamza was a vile, disgusting man in so many ways, but none more so than in his penchant for young girls. Prepubescent girls, to be precise. David had discovered this perverse side of the general while he'd been watching him for the last several months. There had been at least two other occasions that David knew of where the general's bodyguards had snatched young Palestinian girls from the street and brought them back to the hotel so the general could have his fun with them. Using his contacts with the local Jordanian authorities, David dug around and found that the police had actually attempted to question the general about some of the girls who had been abducted. Several days later, word had come down from the highest of places, telling the police not to harass General Hamza. The Jordanians were not about to let the welfare of a handful of young Palestinian girls interfere with their relations with Iraq. As David tied a climbing rope to the side of his balcony, he focused on the task at hand. This would not be the first time he'd killed, and it certainly wouldn't be the last. He always operated with a calm precision that steered clear of either anger or pleasure. Tonight, however, he was finding it a bit difficult to suppress some of his feelings about the job at hand. The arrogance of General Hamza had gotten to him. The Iraqis had co-opted the Palestinian issue under the guise of Arab Brotherhood for the simple goal of driving a wedge between the Arab states and America. If it was only that, David could live with it. He had a grudging respect for America and, in the end, felt they would do what was right. And if it was only the way the Iraqis lied with such vehemence, he could deal with it. Lying to other tribes was an accepted part of the culture of his people. What really boiled his blood, however, was the way the Iraqis treated Palestinians when the cameras weren't around. It was their arrogance and condescension, and on top of that, the way they bullied their brothers in arms. When you fought your way through all the blustery dictums and rhetoric, the Iraqis were out for no one other than themselves. There was one more thing about the Iraqi general that tested David's composure. It was his utter contempt of and downright hatred for women. Growing up in Jerusalem, David was the only boy in his family. He had three older sisters. His father was Palestinian and his mother Jordanian. Both had been educated in Britain. His father was an attorney and his mother was a doctor. In a part of the world where equality between the sexes was still a long way off, David had grown up in a house where there was never a doubt that his mother and father were on the same footing. In fact, if pressed, David would probably admit that his mother was the more dominant of the two. All three of his sisters had gone to America and had become doctors. The two eldest remained in the States where they practiced medicine, and the youngest had come back to help her mother with her practice in Jerusalem. David held his sisters in the highest regard, and unlike many of his Arab brothers, he did not adhere to the belief that women should be treated like property. As David tied off the black climbing rope, he muttered a curse and stopped fighting his anger. Nothing boiled his blood more than someone taking advantage of the weak. He pulled on a pair of leather gloves and, splaying his fingers apart, worked the leather down firmly into one crook after another. After checking his weapons one last time, he pulled a black balaclava over his head and adjusted it so only his dark eyes were visible. With everything in order, he swung one leg over the edge and then the other. Loosening his grip ever so slightly, David slithered slowly down the rope until his foot touched the railing of the balcony beneath. Deftly, he leapt from his perch and landed softly on the concrete surface of the balcony. What little noise he made was masked by the music coming from within the room. Cautiously, he leaned around at the edge of the wall to see what was going on inside. The sheer curtain was drawn, but the heavy curtain was not. The room was lit with candles, and David could make out a form hovering near what he knew to be the bed. David saw the form jerk in a forward motion, and he thought he heard a muffled scream follow. Moving back quickly, he took off his backpack and then placed his hand on the door. Slowly, he applied pressure and was not surprised to find that the door was locked. Crouching, he reached into the backpack and extracted a thin piece of sheet metal with a notch in the end. David took the piece of metal and gently wedged it between the frame and the heavy sliding glass door. Twisting it counterclockwise, he waited until he had the right amount of tension and then lifted up. Not pausing to see if the general had heard the click, David slid the piece of sheet metal into his coat pocket with one hand and grabbed for his silenced 9mm gun with the other. With his eyes trained on the shadow on the other side of a large suite, he began opening the door. Moving the sheer curtain out of the way, he stepped into the room and was sickened by what he saw. Standing naked over the girl, a sweaty General Hamza brought a riding crop high above his head and let loose with a wicked blow. The young girl was tied to the bed face down, spread-eagle, with a gag in her mouth. Her entire body shuddered as the leather crop met her flesh. She tried to scream, but it only came out as another muffled cry. Her delicate skin had been breached in at least a dozen places. David stared in horror at the long, bloody welts. Hamza, with his back to him, raised the crop above his head again, poised to unleash another blow. David suddenly wanted very badly to hurt him, not just kill him. Moving quickly, he reached Hamza just as the crop was about to strike the girl. His right hand came crashing down in a motion that mimicked Hamza's, but before the leather crop could strike the girl again, the black steel of David's pistol made contact with the base of the general's neck. Hamza dropped the riding crop instantly, lurching forward and falling unsteadily to one knee. David hovered over him for a split second and then unleashed a second blow. This time the pistol grip landed on the top of Hamza's head. The general wavered for a moment like a tree that couldn't decide which way it would fall, and then, before gravity could take hold, David reached out and grabbed a handful of hair. Not wanting to alert the bodyguards in the next room, he carefully lowered the naked body of Hamza to the floor. David grabbed a sheet and covered the young girl. As he looked down at Hamza with disgust and hatred, a battle was raging within him. All of his instincts told him to finish off the general and then take care of the bodyguards. That would be the professional way to proceed. The vengeful voice in his head, though, wanted the general to suffer, and it was winning. David moved for the door that connected the general's room to that of his bodyguards. Without a moment of hesitation, he grabbed the handle and yanked it open. He knew the layout of the room, and his silenced pistol was up and already sweeping the area where he'd most likely find the two thugs, while he stayed in the doorway, hugging the frame to reduce his silhouette on the off chance one of the men might get off a shot. Neither of them did. They were watching TV and looked up, expecting to see their boss, but instead found a man wearing a black mask and pointing a gun at them. The weapon was fired twice in less than half a second. At a distance of just 18 feet, David never doubted his accuracy. Both 9mm subsonic hollow-tipped rounds found their mark, hitting the bodyguard's dead center between the eyes. The two Iraqis died instantly. David closed and locked the door, and then after another brief internal battle, he decided on a course of action. From an assassin's point of view, it wasn't the smart thing to do, but it was definitely the right thing to do. He would have to deviate from his well-planned script, but he wasn't about to leave this poor young girl behind in the hotel room to face further pain and humiliation when the police arrived. No, she would be coming with him. He was getting ahead of himself, though. First, he had to think of an appropriate way to kill the naked Iraqi pig who was lying on the floor before him. David began cutting the young girl's bonds, and with each slice of the knife, the proper death sentence became more clear to him. Chapter 11
Rapp's performance wasn't exactly what Kennedy had had in mind, but she could tell that it had an impact on the president. An added bonus was that Kennedy couldn't remember a time when she'd seen Valerie Jones so flustered. The president's animated chief of staff was silenced for once, waiting desperately for someone else to come to her defense now that Rapp had left. She looked from the president to Flood to Kennedy and then back around again. Having found no comfort, she settled on looking out the window and tapping her foot. Kennedy wondered if Jones honestly thought she would receive any solace from her or General Flood. After several more moments of tense silence, Jones couldn't take it anymore. She looked at the president and blurted, "I warned you that having him around was a bad idea." President Hayes looked at his chief of staff evenly. "I don't always agree with Mitch's opinions, but I do always value them."
"Robert, he doesn't see the big picture. He doesn't understand the negative impact this type of scandal will have on your presidency."
Hayes cocked his head a bit to the side and said, "I have a feeling that Mitch would say it's you who don't see the big picture." Jones exhaled in frustration.
"I'm not going to sit here and debate the big picture with some assassin from the CIA.
Jones turned to Kennedy and said, "No offense, Irene, but I'm paid to put all the pieces of the puzzle together and minimize the president's exposure. You don't have to have a doctorate in political science to figure out what's going to happen when this story breaks. We are going to get eaten alive by the press, and then the committees on the Hill will begin to call for hearings." She turned her attention to Hayes. "And they will make damn sure they drag you through the mud right up to your re-election." To everyone's surprise, Kennedy said, "I agree with Valerie." Looking smug with her newfound support, Jones said,
"Even his own boss agrees with me."
Kennedy held up a finger and added, "I do, but with one exception. You'll never be able to keep a lid on this. The press already knows something's up. By the end of today, they'll have a pretty good handle on this story, and we'll probably see our first installment in the morning papers."
"But we can handle that," Jones jumped in. "I already have our people working on the press release. The servicemen were lost in a joint training exercise with the Philippine Army."
Jones looked to General Flood.
"This type of thing happens all the time, right?"
Before the general could answer, the president said, "The Philippine ambassador has already called twice this morning, and I assure you it wasn't to talk about the weather." Jones batted away the concern with her hand.
"They need our aid to prop up their economy. All we need to do is throw them some more money and they'll play ball."
Kennedy slowly shook her head.
"Too many people know about this, sir. There's no way you're going to be able to keep a lid on it."
The president was leaning back now, tapping his forefinger against his upper lip. Before he could say anything, Jones jumped back into the debate.
"Give me 1 week, that's all I'm asking for. 1 week, and I'll have the press looking into something else, I promise."
Hayes looked to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and said, "General, you're unusually quiet this morning. Is there anything you'd care to add?" General Flood was an imposing man, and even more so in his uniform. A few inches over 6 feet tall and pushing 300 pounds, he looked more like a retired football player than a man who still liked to jump out of planes a couple of times a year. It was evident from his face that he was trying to choose his words carefully. Keeping his eyes on the president, he finally said, "Sir, I couldn't disagree with Miss Jones more emphatically." The president was looking at Flood, but from the corner of his eye, he could see his chief of staff begin to squirm. Ignoring her, he said, "Please elaborate."
"We have announced that we are at war with terrorism. We have proof that at a bare minimum, a Philippine general is taking bribes from a known terrorist organization that has taken a family of Americans hostage. We have proof that a State Department official who was told in no uncertain terms that this rescue operation was to be kept secret decided on her own volition to break federal law and discuss this information with an overseas State Department official. We have a U.S. ambassador who took it upon himself to brief the head of a foreign country that U.S. special forces were about to conduct a covert operation on that country's soil. Any reasonable person would conclude that these actions clearly led to the deaths of 2 U.S. Navy SEALs.
You have said it yourself, Mr. President. We are at war.
This is serious business. And in my mind, the ambassador and the undersecretary are traitors, and their actions cannot go unpunished.
I agree that they should be punished, Jones said quickly before anyone else could speak. I say we ship them off to the worst posting we can think of. I say we not only make them take a cut in pay, but we make them pay restitution to the families of the two dead soldiers. I say
dead sailors, the general corrected her.
Looking back to the president, he added,
I happen to agree with Mitch. If it were up to me, I would have these two marched in front of a firing squad and shot. But I realize in today's world that'll never happen. I do, however, think they need to spend some hard time in jail, and they need to be publicly humiliated. They need to be made an example of.
Jones, desperate to turn the tide of this conversation, weighed in once more.
General, I'm not saying I disagree with you, but again, I don't think you're looking at how this scandal will affect this administration.
With all due respect, Miss Jones, I'm more concerned with the welfare of this republic than any single administration. The two should go hand in hand, but as you've so passionately pointed out this morning, that's not always the case.
Jones glared at the general and said,
That was a cheap shot.
No, it was a direct shot, but if I wasn't blunt enough for you, let me spell this entire clusterfuck out for you in clear English.
The general leaned toward the chief of staff and said,
This was a big operation. A lot of military and intelligence personnel knew about it beforehand, and since it went south, a lot more people know about it today.
Flood stuck out one of his beefy fingers with conviction and said,
I can guarantee you, if you try to whitewash this thing, someone in uniform or over at Langley is going to be so offended they will talk to a reporter off the record, and they will set off a chain reaction that will do exactly what you're hoping to avoid. And that's if Mitch doesn't break the story first.
You worry about your people, General, Jones shot back, and I'll handle Rapp.
The sheer lunacy of the comment caused Flood to roar with laughter.
You're going to tell Mitch Rapp what to do? Let me know when and where, and I'll pay top dollar to witness that fight.
Before Jones could speak again, the president came forward in his chair and rested his forearms on his desk.
I've made a decision. He was talking to everyone, but was looking at Jones. We're going to confront this thing head on, and it's not up for debate. If we try to bury it, it'll only come back and bite us in the ass. I want the Justice Department to prepare warrants for the arrest of Assistant Secretary Petrie and Ambassador Cox.
Jones began shaking her head.
Robert!
Before she could continue, the president cut her off and said, Valerie, cancel my dinner plans for this evening and inform the congressional leadership that I'd like to meet with him.
Jones had a pained expression on her face.
The president's demeanor suggested that any further protests would be unwise. She'd lost this one for now, but there was always later. When she had him alone, she would try to get him to rethink his decision before he jumped off the cliff. With strained pleasantness, Jones asked,
What would you like me to tell them?
Tell them I need to brief them on an issue of national security.
I'll get to work on it right away.
Before leaving, she turned to Kennedy.
You'll keep me informed of any decisions you reach with the DOJ and the FBI.
Kennedy noticed it was more a demand than a question, but nonetheless nodded politely. Jones had been thoroughly defeated, and there was no sense rubbing it in. When the chief of staff was gone, the president addressed Kennedy and Flood.
I'm sorry about that. Politics comes first for Valerie. She can't help it.
Flood shook his oversized head and grumbled something.
Kennedy watched the general with pursed lips and then added, No need to apologize, sir. You need people who will watch out for the political ramifications.
That's true, agreed the president, but that doesn't mean we have to check our morals at the door.
Hayes's face twisted into a disapproving frown.
Valerie's tendency is to try to control everything. She doesn't understand that the American people will cut you a lot of slack as long as you're up front with them and they know you had the right intentions. In this situation, it's pretty cut and dried.
Hayes laid his hands flat on his desk and moved several pieces of paper around while he pondered precisely how to proceed.
I want to do the right thing here.
I want to be up front on this, and I want to move very quickly. I don't want some hotshot reporter breaking this before we get out in front of it. Otherwise, I'm afraid Valerie will be proven right, and I'll be crucified on the hill.
If I may, sir?
Asked Kennedy. The president nodded, and she said, You might not want to wait for tonight. The general and I could begin briefing select members of the various committees this afternoon. Then when you meet with them tonight, you can give them the entire story. I would caution you, though, that we need to keep General Morrow and his involvement out of this. The president's expression went from keen to confused. Why? Kennedy hesitated and then said,
Mitch has come up with a solution for dealing with the general. If you have time, I think we should get him back in here so he can explain it to you.
The president eyed the director of the CIA with great curiosity. Since diplomacy was far from Mitch Rapp's area of expertise, the president was very curious about what his top counterterrorism operative had in the works. Two Navy SEALs were dead, a family of Americans were still held hostage, and his presidency was on the brink of scandal. Right now, the idea of retribution seemed very appealing.
This ends Disc 2.